Marty Moscoen, welcome to Radio Times. Protests sparked by a crude anti-Islamic video that began a week ago in Cairo have spread to other countries around the world. 14 people were killed by a suicide bomber in Kabul, Afghanistan today, reportedly as vengeance for the insulting film. The Associated Press is reporting that a North African branch of Al-Qaeda called yesterday for more attacks on U.S. diplomats. Meanwhile, the U.S. and Libyan governments are investigating the attacks on the American consulate in Benghazi that killed the U.S. ambassador and three Americans last Tuesday. According to a report today by McClatchy, the Obama administration says the assault was inspired by protests in Cairo, while a Libyan official said the attack was organized by foreigners with links to Al-Qaeda. We begin our conversation with Nancy Youssef, who covers the Middle East for McClatchy, and she joins us from Cairo. And Nancy Youssef, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you.
Can you describe the streets of Cairo today?
They're actually pretty calm and have been since Friday when we saw sort of the height of the protesting here. Part of that is because there's a lot of security in Tahrir Square and at the embassy. Part of it is because a lot of the groups that had called for the protests have since said that people should essentially stay home. The Muslim Brotherhood, which had earlier a week ago said that there should be protests, has now called for a symbolic protest, which essentially means to stay off the streets. And I actually think there's a real discussion and soul-searching going on here about how the Islamic world should defend the faith. I think despite the numbers of people we saw protesting, I think they really represented a small minority. And the majority of people here, while offended by the movie, sort of had the reaction, well, one wrong shouldn't be answered with another. So I think all of that has led to a quieter Cairo for now, until there's something else that triggers this conversation or this reaction again.
Is this public or private soul-searching, as you describe it, Nancy?
It's mostly private. I mean, it's one of these things you go around and you talk to people of various economic backgrounds, people who are religious, people who are more secular, and there was a real sense of embarrassment, frankly, about how Egypt reacted. There's a feeling that people should be allowed to defend the faith and should defend it, but that to do so violently essentially made Islam look bad. And so it's nothing public, but it's a conversation I've had over and over again with the Egyptians here. And it's only sort of reinforced by when you talk to the protesters and you ask them why they're there, nobody could give you a cogent answer. They would say, We want the United States to apologize. Okay, well, they have apologized. Well, we want the United States to investigate the movie. Well, they are investigating. We want an international law banning any insult of the prophet. And then you say, well, okay, but didn't you guys have a revolution so that you could have more freedom to suppress others? And they kind of run out of things to say. And so it's not as, I think, nationalistic as or as monolithic. Egypt isn't as it looked, I think, a week ago when those protests were going on.
Is the U.S. Embassy in Cairo still on high alert? This would, of course, be a week after the protests and then the assault on the embassy.
Yeah, it is. They haven't gotten back to being a fully functioning embassy yet. Every day they put out a tweet saying, all right, today's the day we're going to resume our visa section, and then they cancel. And so it's certainly more fortified than it was a week ago. There's a very hastily put up wall in front of the road that leads to it. There are hundreds of police around it, and I was over there a couple of days ago, and it certainly doesn't have a feel of that it did a week ago. It feels more fortified. It feels less safe somehow. And you talk to embassy staff, and they're still sort of determining at what point they can go back to being a fully functioning embassy.
And what has President Morsi said in the last couple of days, if anything?
He hasn't. But what's interesting is he'll be headed to the United States next week. He leaves here Sunday. I think it was supposed to be sort of a heralded trip, and now we're not even sure of what the agenda is. At one point, we expected him to go to the White House and meet with the president. We're not sure if that's going to happen. At the minimum, he'll be going to the United Nations. Pure conjecture on my part. My guess is he'll go there and give a speech talking about how peaceful Islam is, and then at the same time condemn the reaction to the film. But you know, Morsi's really tried to walk back essentially the first few days of silence, and I think it really put it really dampened relations between the two countries, because it was Obama who had to call President Morsi, and not the other way around. You would think, after U.S. embassies attacked her, that the president of that country would be reaching out to the United States. That it had to be the other way around. I think really embarrassed this administration here, and they're trying to undo the damage. So we haven't heard anything from him specifically in the last couple of days. But in his defense, there hasn't been a need to say anything because the streets have been relatively calm.
How much, even of the protests, or even from people that you talk to, Nancy, in Cairo, how much of what we have seen on the street is frustration with unemployment in Egypt, or even the continued corruption in the country, and perhaps even raise expectations from the Arab Spring that life was going to get better?
I think it's all of that. I mean, I think of Egypt as sort of the big vat of oil, and everybody, and these things like the movie are a spark. And in that vat of oil is unemployment, it's frustration with the police, it's sort of unfulfilled expectations of the revolution. It's people looking for it's unemployed men who are looking for a purpose, and suddenly they're given one to defend the faith. I think the United States has to be careful about how much it makes us about the United States, even though it seemingly was that way, right? I mean, there are people protesting to defend the U.S. Embassy. It should be presumably about the United States, and in some ways it is. But it's really part of this complex matrix of issues that have confounded Egypt before the revolution and since. So a lot of it is about sort of unresolved issues here, including how the Middle East relates to the United States. But I think it would be a mistake to assume that was the predominant factor in all this.
And again, that's Nancy Youssef. She covers the Middle East for McClatchy, getting our conversation started in this hour of Radio Times, looking at the protests that began in Cairo, have spread to countries around the world. And Nancy, let me go back to you and your colleague, Jonathan Lande, had a piece in McClatchy today, shifting gears, looking at Libya. And interestingly, yes, he wrote that on the one hand, and the Obama administration is investigating what happened that led to the death of the U.S. ambassador and three Americans, and the Libyan, I guess, government is doing the same thing. But they seem to be coming, at least today, at very different conclusions. The U.S. saying that these protests were inspired by what happened in Cairo. And as I said in the beginning, quoting from McClatchy, that a Libyan official said the attack was organized by foreigners with links to Al-Qaeda. Can you help us understand what's going on in Libya?
Sure. I mean, we've spoken to several people who were there at the scene, who said that there was no protest beforehand, that this was a brazen attack that included as many as 125 people coming at the compound from various directions, launching RPGs, grenades. One guard told us, don't you think if there were protests, the Americans would have left? So from the ground here, it's shocking, this idea that it was a spontaneous attack, that these are the reports coming from the United States, because to talk to people on the ground, they're so consistent in their version, and they're also consistent with what U.S. officials were putting out to reporters in the early days about what had happened. Of course, everybody has their own agenda, and I think for the Libyan president, it's to absolve his country and his countrymen of this attack. There's a great sense of shame amongst Benghazis that they weren't able to take care of their most highly regarded guest, someone who was so directly involved in their liberation, who helped bring about the NATO intervention that saved Benghazi a year ago. And the U.S. reasons, maybe their investigation is showing something different than what's finding here. I think it's also a way to say that the security at the facility wasn't as problematic as it seems on the surface, because this is something that started peacefully and exploded. But my counter would be that if there was even a protest there, why would the ambassador be kept there? I have the bias, and I've been listening to one person after another on the ground say something completely different. And, you don't bring RPGs and grenades and guns to a peaceful protest, seems to me.
But does it also raise concerns that on the anniversary of September 11th, a group perhaps affiliated with Al-Qaeda attacking a U.S. consulate in Libya and killing four Americans?
Of course. It means that this wasn't about a movie, but this is about something bigger. This is about potentially the U.S. killing of a Libby, who was the top Libyan official in Al-Qaeda, that elements of Al-Qaeda are allowed to operate in a way that they weren't allowed to operate under Gaddafi, that a liberated Libya that has essentially allowed these groups to thrive. A country that the United States helped liberate. So it certainly raises questions about whether the liberation of Libya has improved or endangered U.S. interests and U.S. security. I think both can be true. I think there are versions in both sides that are true. What remains unclear, even after all this time, is whether Ambassador Stevens is targeted or not, because his physical—he died of carbon monoxide poisoning and suffocation. So there was no indication of being shot or beaten or struck in any way, which would suggest that perhaps he wasn't targeted. But at the same time, it was well known in Benghazi that that's where he stayed and that he was coming to Benghazi for a public event. So it's unclear who did it, and it's also unclear the motive behind it. And I think that's what you're seeing in these two different versions, but. I would just advise the listeners to kind of keep in mind everybody has an agenda in terms of the version of events that they've given us, given what happened, and given what's at stake for both the United States and Libya.
Nancy, about a minute before we have to say goodbye to you, and just looking ahead and from your expertise in this region, what are you looking at? What are you looking to investigate to try to understand?
Well, whether the Morsi government can do anything to sort of mitigate the factors that led to these protests, because if not, then essentially we're all waiting for the next sort of spark to set these off again, and that we repeat the cycle as we have for years and years. Can the Morsi government do it? Can an Islamist-led government, make the kinds of social as well as economic changes such that people are not as compelled or as angry as they are in the streets of Cairo right now, and can react to these things in a more peaceful way? That's just sort of the most immediate concern and the highest sort of expectation of the revolution, that there could be a representative, responsive government that could bring about real change, that the change didn't simply happen with who's the head of state, but that it happened in a way that positively and substantively improves the lives of Egyptians, because it's all connected to what happened a week ago.
Well, Nancy Youssef, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She's a reporter who covers the Middle East and the Islamic world for McClatchy Newspapers. We have two guests waiting in the wings as we carry on our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Friends Select, the Center City Quaker School, supports WHYY. Friends Select combines academics with real-world exploration in the classroom, in Philadelphia, and beyond. By asking questions and inviting students to make independent discoveries, Friends Select teachers do more than instruct. They strive to spark lasting fascination. An open house is Thursday, September 20th. Full details at friends-select.org. Friends Select. Fascination. Forever bright.
Next time in Studio 360, The Satanic Verses was a worldwide bestseller, but its author spent almost a decade hiding from the Ayatollah Khomeini's executioners. I'll talk with Salman Rushdie about his new memoir next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
So your baby's under the weather, your childcare is shaky, but you have to go to work. What do you do? American University professor Adrienne Pine took the baby to class and breastfed her while there. She says it was no big deal, so why did the story end up on the front page of the Washington Post? Big deal or stupid dust-up? We'll ask our moms next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. It's been a week since protests erupted in Cairo, Egypt, and the U.S. ambassador to Libya and three Americans were killed in Benghazi. Demonstrations that began in Cairo have spread to other countries around the world. And we just got an update on Egypt and Libya from McClatchy's Nancy Youssef. Now we want to talk about if the U.S. can do anything more or different to win over hearts and minds in the Arab world and the Muslim world. And joining us is Khaled El-Gindi. He's a fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. And Khaled El-Gindi, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Michelle Dunn, director of the Rafi Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. And Michelle Dunn, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
Khaled, if I could begin with you. To help us understand what happened a week ago and how this unrest has spread around the world, does everything trace back to this crude and, I have to say, cartoonish, insulting 14-minute trailer?
Well, I think Nancy actually had it just right in that there are a lot of reasons for there's a lot going on here, much more than meets the eye, certainly. And this isn't just about a film. There is a generalized anger in Egypt and elsewhere around the region. There's an impatience with the pace of change. There's certainly in Egypt, there's a ongoing mistrust of the police force. There's massive economic hardship, ongoing poverty, beneath the surface, you have this very deep reservoir of mistrust towards the United States. And so people are prepared to believe almost anything about the United States. And, you know, there were lots of different manifestations of these various grievances, I think, being played out over the last week. And it's not solely about this film. I think Nancy had it right in that this, you know, the film was the spark, but the anger touched on so many other issues.
Michelle, how do you see it?
Well, I would say that, you know, this incident reminds me of a number of incidents that have happened in recent years. If we recall a few years ago, the issue of the Danish cartoon that depicted the Prophet Muhammad, you know, in an insulting way, or if we think of Salman Rushdie's book, et cetera. There have been a number of these incidents. I mean, there is a kind of a well, I think, of resentment in the Muslim world against the West, a sense that somehow the not only the United States but others in the West, you know, repeatedly insult Islam, and partly because there are Islamist political movements, there's a certain amount of competition, I think, for people to stand up and defend Islam against these insults. And it gets used, you know, in local ways. We saw it used here in Egypt by the Salafis. In Libya, we're seeing it now used in Lebanon, in Pakistan. You know, unfortunately, it's the kind of a general grievance or well of resentment that people can dip into and draw on for their own reasons.
Khaled, picking up on that and going back to you, and just a question I have, because I don't understand the answer, which is there is obvious outrage about this film, and as Michelle said, the cartoons, the satanic verses, but why isn't there equal outrage about what the Assad government is doing in Syria, or even the numbers of Muslims that have been killed by Al-Qaeda? What explains, I guess, the different reaction to obviously these threats to either Muslim beliefs or to actual people?
Well, I think there is outrage on, certainly in Egypt, people are outraged about what's happening in Syria. And you can see it in the social media, and you can see it in local newspapers, and people talk about it. People see the images on their TVs at home. But I think it also matters, you know, you have to look at this in the context of, it matters who is saying something and when and how. Mm. And the fact that this was a, as you said, very crude, amateurish film put together, it was done in the United States. And so, you know, like I said, people are prepared to believe almost anything about the United States. And so they see this as a direct and deliberate attack on their religion, and which of course is something that they hold very dear. The situation is in Syria is something that they feel outrage over, but probably a sense of resignation and they can't do much about it. So I think it's not necessarily a fair comparison.
Mm. Well, Michelle, just picking up on that, and I wonder, even in trying to understand the and I hate to speak generally about countries or even individuals, but the Arab world or the Muslim world, do you think there is a kind of profound misunderstanding about freedom of speech? We have in this country freedom of speech. You can say horrible and offensive things about people, and we have to figure out how to live with that or condemn it. But whether that has translated to, whether we're talking about Cairo or what might be going on in Indonesia, is there a misunderstanding about what free speech is about?
Certainly countries draw the limits on freedom of speech in significantly different places. I mean, in countries like Egypt and, you know, there are laws against blasphemy, against insulting religion. In many countries around the world, not just Muslim countries, there are laws against insulting political leaders or the head of state, for example. We don't have those in the United States. I mean, we set very, the limits on freedom of speech here are very small. You know, it really needs to be incitement to violence, for example, or, hate speech. But we've had a lot of arguments in the United States about racist speech and so forth. And we permit a lot of things here because we value freedom of speech so highly that other countries don't. And that does create a misunderstanding. But I want to emphasize again that people are deliberately using this. This whole issue about this film was brought to light and spread started by a Salafi televangelist in Egypt. And there's a specific fight going on there about how much Islam is going to be in the new constitution, and how, of course, the new constitution will mention Islam as the religion of the state. However, will it say things about blasphemy and so forth? And the Salafis in Egypt, I think, saw an opportunity to take this issue and run with it and show that they were the defenders of Islam more than the Muslim Brotherhood President Morsi is, and also that they are able to create a lot of trouble if their concerns and their desires for how to shape the new Egypt are not listened to.
Holly, do you want to respond to that?
I think Michelle is absolutely right, and I think the mistake that the Egyptian president made was in following rather than leading. In that particular moment, he was sort of acting as a Muslim brother rather than a president who obviously had a responsibility to protect the American embassy, but also had a responsibility to not let things get out of control. And I think the initial backing through his silence that he provided was also political, and it was motivated by a sense of populism or domestic politics. He didn't want to be, as Michelle said, outflanked by these more hardcore Salafi groups when it comes to defending Islam. So I think that's a calculation that he may wish he could take back, but it's a I think Michelle's absolutely right. This is an issue that was exploited for political purposes by many different groups.
Khalid, we live in this internet interconnected world, and you know, idiots can put things on YouTube, whether it's this crude video. You can be an obscure pastor in Florida and burn a Quran and you know, create havoc around the world. How does, and if we're speaking about the Muslim world or speaking about what's going on in the Muslim/Arab world, you know, how do they live? I mean, you can't have protests and attacks every time someone says something stupid on the internet.
That's right, and I think, you know, it's a learning process for everyone, and certainly the Egyptian president and his new government. And I think, you know, as Nancy said, there's a certain amount of soul searching that's happening in Egypt. People are realizing, is this really the best way to defend our religion or our prophet? And I think a very large but maybe silent majority probably feel uncomfortable with the way things played out on the street. I'm not sure. I mean, but it's a process. You know, I'm not sure that it's going to lead to automatic changes. One thing we can be sure of is that the kind of reaction that this film sparked is probably likely to inspire more coming from Islamophobes in the U.S. and the West and other parts of the world. I mean, this is, you know, in a way, the extremist fringes are exploiting this to their own ends and really fanning things, but they're also justifying their own existence by doing this. So on a certain level, I think people in the region are going to have to get used to this sort of thing, if only because we're likely to see more of it.
And that's Khaled El-Gindi. He's a fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah on permanent status negotiations with Israel, was a key participant in negotiations at Annapolis in November 2007. Michelle Dunn, director of the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. She has served in the White House on the National Security Council staff, on the State Department's policy planning staff, and in its Bureau of Intelligence and Research, and also as a diplomat in Cairo and Jerusalem. We are talking about the protests that were sparked a week ago by a very crude, amateurish, and insulting movie made here in the United States. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Michelle, going back to you, do you think there's something that President Obama should do or say to, if not quell some of these protests, at least respond to them?
I think that President Obama has, he's tried repeatedly to show respect for Islam. You know, he had a big speech in Cairo in May of 2009 where he tried to sort of reset, so to speak, U.S. relations with the Muslim world and express, as I said, a great deal of respect for Islam as a religion and so forth. In this specific case, there is an investigation of the film going on in the United States to see whether there's any prosecutable offense here. I doubt at that, but at least they're showing that they're looking into it. And Secretary Clinton, you know, has, and President Obama have called the film, you know, insulting and so forth. At the same time, you know, they do have to stand up for free speech and explain that, first of all, this is a privately made film that has nothing to do with the U.S. government, has nothing to do with U.S. policy, and that the way that U.S. laws are written, speech that is highly insulting and religiously blasphemous is not against the law. So the thing that I think, though, is there's a broader picture here. There are ways in which, since these Arab uprisings started a year and a half ago, President Obama could have done more to lead. There is a great deal of disappointment with Obama in the Muslim world. There's a sense that he gave a wonderful speech and everyone felt good, but there wasn't that much to follow up on it. There was a lot of disappointment with his failed efforts to broker a resolution of the Palestine issue. And in addition to that, there's a sense that since the Arab revolutions happened, that U.S. support for the countries, for Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, has been lukewarm, that the U.S. has offered minimal economic support to these countries and has not really played the kind of leadership role the United States is capable of playing. When we really want to help, for example, a fledgling democracy, you know, we can go out and galvanize support from international financial institutions and other international actors, donors, and so forth. And that while the United States has done a little bit of that, it's been kind of at a low level, and people in the Middle East feel the United States is ambivalent about the changes in these countries and not as supportive as it could be.
Khalid, ambivalent?
I think that's true. I think the United States is ambivalent, actually, about these changes. They were clearly uncomfortable when these uprisings began because they're not really sure where things were going to end up. And I think they remain kind of skittish also about where things seem to be headed. With Islamists coming to power, they've reconciled themselves to the fact that Islamists are coming to power and that they're going to have to deal with them. And I think they've adapted to that change fairly well in relative terms. But the United States has an awful lot of interests around the region. And whether it's Israel or oil or the Suez Canal or counterterrorism, and those didn't just disappear because Arabs decided that they wanted to get rid of their dictators. And so it's a long transition for the United States. It's a big learning curve for everyone involved, including this administration and the United States.
Khaled, how much do you think the ongoing Palestinian-Israeli conflict feeds into this discontent?
I think it does, not necessarily in a direct way. I think it is a sign of it's this festering wound that's been there and will continue to be there as proof that nothing's really changed on the part of the United States and how they're behaving in the region. The Obama administration is exactly like the second Bush administration, the second term of the last president, and except that everything has come to a grinding halt in terms of a so-called peace process. But obviously they have other problems to contend with, and they're not right now thinking about the Palestinian issue, but it is there as part of the kind of, it's an ongoing grievance, and in a way it's a litmus test for whether there's been a real change in Washington or not.
Michelle, about a minute before our break here, how do you see this ongoing, lack of resolution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict?
You know, that issue is fairly quiet now, but it's highly unstable. Something's going to give at some point, because we still have, Palestinians living in the West Bank under this unusual regime where they're not fully under military occupation, but they're not fully ruling themselves either. We have a break between the West Bank and Gaza with Hamas in control of Gaza. And so, these disconnected pieces of, Israel and a West Bank in this ambiguous status, Gaza in an ambiguous status. Something's going to happen at some point. And we see from time to time, including recently, sort of things bubbling up on the Palestinian side. We could see another Palestinian uprising. And there's also an Israeli government that is less interested in negotiating peace with the Palestinians than some of its predecessors have been. So at some point, this issue is going to force itself, back onto the front burner and become a real problem again for the United States and for the region.
We're going to take that short break, get back to our conversation with Michelle Dunn and Khaled El-Gindi. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. Independence Blue Cross is dedicated to transforming healthcare to make a better coordinated system that is built around you. They're committed to leading the way to focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it, pioneering new ways to pay healthcare professionals based on the quality of care, and using technology to update your medical information electronically so everyone can be informed. Further details online at ibx.com. Independence Blue Cross, changing the game. On the next Fresh Air, journalist Gaith Abdul-Ahad talks about traveling with Syrian rebel fighters for his new PBS Frontline documentary. He says the rebels don't have enough helmets, flak jackets, or experience.
In Syria, you meet someone in the morning and they die in the end of the day. As one of the officers was saying, the only thing we have plenty of is men.
Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The presidential campaigns are spending lots for online and social media ads. What are they getting in return? Also, the Boston doctor who was in Benghazi to meet with Ambassador Chris Stevens the day he was killed. We'll find out why. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking about the anti-American protests that began in Cairo a week ago as have spread to other countries around the world. What do these protests mean? What questions does it raise about U.S. foreign policy? And again, our guests are Michelle Dunn, director of the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council, and Khaled El-Gindi, fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Matt from Malvern to join our conversation. Matt, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, yes. Thank you. I find it interesting that many of the leaders of spreading these protests are also active in Holocaust denial. We saw that international conference held by President Ahmadinejad a year or two ago, and you know, I'm insulted by that. I had family in Lithuania that were all wiped out. We can prove it. Mahmoud Abbas wrote his PhD thesis on Holocaust denial.
But Matt,
delicate sensibilities too, but I'm not rioting about it. This is one issue politics, just like the abortion fanatics here. And if they want people to respect their deeply held beliefs, then they need to start reflecting our deeply held beliefs in rational study of history.
Well, Matt, let me take your call, and I'm looking at the computer here. Him believing, I'll put this to you, Khaled, that Muslims disrespect other religions.
Well, of course, you can't generalize about, you know, more than a billion Muslims around the world, what they do and don't respect. I think there are elements, certainly, in Egypt and elsewhere that don't respect other faiths. And just as there are here in the United States, those who are promoting anti-Islamic and anti-Muslim hysteria here as well. So I think, you know, the issue of Holocaust denial actually is an interesting one because it sort of shows it kind of illustrates a point that Michelle was making earlier about different countries have different lines in the sand that they draw as far as free speech. And in Europe, for example, Holocaust denial is illegal. It is not in the United States, and a lot of, I think, Arabs and Muslims don't understand that. They kind of think that that there are red lines similar to their red lines, whether it's religion or Holocaust denial or something along those lines, that there really is no other country like the United States that has almost unfettered, unbridled kind of belief in free speech the way we do here. And so it's very hard for people to accept that in the region. And so when they saw this happening, they assumed that it was with the approval of the United States. Otherwise, they would have prevented it.
Michelle, I didn't read the article yet, but I saw the cover of Newsweek this week. It says Muslim Rage, and it's a picture of clearly very enraged men. And the lead article is by Ayan Hirsi Ali. And one of the things she claims is that extremist Muslims are not a fringe group. That's a quote there. On the contrary, they represent the mainstream of contemporary Islam. And of course, you know, there's an article being published in the United States by a Somali-born Dutch scholar. She's actually been a guest on this show. I don't know if you've read it or not, but do you think this helps us understand the situation?
Well, look, what I would say is this. I think, you know, my guess is if Gallup went in and did a poll in a country like Egypt, for example, and asked Egyptians whether they thought that the kind of film that came out should be against the law, should be a prohibited form of speech, something that is, from their point of view, blasphemous and insulting to religion, probably most Egyptians would say, yes, mm-hmm. that should be against the law. However, if you went ahead and asked most Egyptians or Libyans, as we've heard, does that mean people should, you know, commit violence against Americans, against American diplomats? Should you know, burn down an American school, as happened in Tunisia? I think most people would say no. I do think it's extremists who you know, who take these kind of issues and want to use violence to make their point, whereas the opinions themselves might be more broadly held.
Mm. Khaled, let me go back to you and actually shift gears slightly to talk about Libya, the ambassador, Stevens, who was killed there a week ago. You knew him, yes?
Yes, I knew him.
What was he like? I mean, everything I read about him, it seemed like, you know, he is the kind of diplomat that we want working around the world. And if the goal is to win over hearts and minds, it seemed that was his focus.
It really was. And I'll tell you, he was exactly the sort of person I think he epitomized what a diplomat ought to be. Not just someone who comes and repeats talking points of his government, but who interacts with the people and who, above all, has an abiding respect and appreciation for the people and the culture in which he is working. And, you know, when I knew Chris in Jerusalem, he certainly represented that while I knew him there. And he, from what I hear from Libyans, he was extremely well-loved in that country mm-hmm. as well. So he really did epitomize, I think, what an American diplomat ought to be. But again, the people who murdered him are not interested, obviously, in diplomacy, and are not interested in building bridges, or they want to turn hearts and minds against the United States, and so that's why they did what they did. They don't share our goals of building bridges.
Michelle, do you think we're seeing a reconstituted al-Qaeda? There are some reports that the attack on the consulate in Benghazi might have been inspired by people who were inspired by some branch of al-Qaeda in North Africa?
Not necessarily. I don't think there's necessarily a reconstitution of al-Qaeda as some kind of a unified organization, because, you know, over the recent years, U.S. efforts have succeeded, I think, in breaking al-Qaeda down. But we have different branches now, whether it's al-Qaeda in Iraq, in Yemen, and in North Africa. Now, we still don't have the results of the investigation in Libya. It seems very likely that Libyan Salafis were involved. Were they working perhaps with other jihadi elements from al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, the little version of al-Qaeda that exists in North Africa? That's a possibility. There are also some suspicions that they could have been working with supporters of the former Gaddafi regime, who have been very active in Libya. You know, one thing is, when events like this happen, they often don't happen in isolation. If you look back over the last 6 months or so, there's been an increasing pace of attacks inside Libya. There was a previous bombing at the U.S. consulate in Libya, a small one. There were a number of Libyan officials assassinated, and so forth. So, you know, there are forces inside of Libya who are looking to destabilize the country because they don't feel part of the political transition, and they don't approve of the direction Libya is going in. And so it's really not clear at this point whether they were working actively with al-Qaeda, or if al-Qaeda is simply trying to take advantage of this. You know, they have said that the killing was in revenge for the killing of this senior Libyan figure, Abu Yahya al-Libi, from al-Qaeda. But it's not clear yet whether that's really true or whether al-Qaeda is trying to make itself look bigger than it really is.
Let me get back to our callers. We have Carl from Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. Carl, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, yes. How are you this morning?
Good. How are you?
Just wondering where do you think our president should stand on enough of this financial aid for these third world countries that we're trying to build back up, give them their freedom. And we have beliefs in this country as much as they do. We look on, watch it on TV of them killing our people, burning down our American schools, burning the American flag. And what if we reacted back with attacking mosques?
Well, Carl,
in our local area.
Okay, what I see as your question is, might Obama pull funds for the Middle East? Let me take that question, and Khalid, let me toss that to you. Does that make sense to you?
I don't think that makes sense. I think, again, we can't generalize about an entire faith or nation or a group of people. It is not the Muslims who are out there burning American flags. There are, of course, individuals and small groups of people who do things. It's unfortunate, though, that they are looked at as representing not just an entire country, but an entire faith of more than a billion people. I think what's needed isn't to stop engaging with these countries, but to engage at a deeper level, to go beyond simply the kind of government to government or government to dictator type of relationship that we've had in the past. And I think to the extent that the United States can build relationships with people and societies in these countries, I think will help along the way.
Even though Ambassador Stevens was murdered?
Well, he was murdered. I mean, it's true, of course. But you have to put it in context. I mean, Libya is a country that is in transition, and they went from a very brutal dictatorship to a country with no civil institutions or very few to speak of, and there are security vacuums around the country that, of course, create a haven for these groups to operate. So it is, you know, what we have today is not the permanent reality, hopefully, but these countries have to you know, build up their capacity on various levels.
Let me get Norman from Newtown to join our conversation. Norman, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Marnie.
Hi.
Your guess is that there's a billion Muslims that shouldn't be painted with the same brush. However, there's tens of millions or maybe even hundreds of millions in Muslim countries with Muslim governments that identify the Muslim religion as the state's religion. However, when they attack Christians or Christians are attacked, they're killed, their churches are burned down, and this is a clear indication that it will continue in any Muslim country where they take over.
Well, Norman, let me find out what Michelle Dunn says to your comments. Michelle, your thoughts.
Well, I think that Norman is speaking specifically about Egypt, where about 10% of the population of about 85 million people are Christians. And there has been a lot of tension between Muslims and Christians in recent years. And I think it's important for us to remember that this was going on before the Egyptian Revolution and before there was a Muslim Brotherhood president in Egypt. There has been discrimination against Christians for decades in Egypt, and there has been a certain amount of violence. There were some, there was a very bad terrorist attack bombing of a Christian church in Alexandria a couple of years ago, and there have been some other very bad incidents. This, you know, they're especially as the Salafi extremist, you know, part of the Islamist movement has grown in recent years, there's been increasing tension with Christians. And to be honest, some of the Salafis have deliberately tried to tried to bait Christians, again, in order to somehow, in some misguided sense, show themselves to be the defenders of Islam and Muslim interests. I fault here the Egyptian government, and this was very much the case under Mubarak, as well, that the Egyptian government has not been willing to face this issue squarely, that it has tried to sweep religious tensions under the rug, that it would tend not to fully prosecute crimes against Christians because they were worried about further inflaming the Islamists. But unfortunately, I think it just created an atmosphere in which people felt that there was impunity for crimes committed against Christians. So that is an underlying problem in Egypt. It's something that any Egyptian government, including the current one, is going to have to deal with. What's been very interesting in the current case with this film, now this film that does appear to have been made at least in part by some Egyptian Christians in the United States, we have seen so far the anger turned against the United States and not against the Christian community in Egypt. I hope that will continue to be the case, because that is a volatile relationship, and it doesn't take much to set off violence between Muslims and Christians in Egypt.
Khalid, we're about 45 seconds from the end of the show. Final thoughts from you?
Well, I think Michelle's right. There is an ongoing sectarian problem in Egypt and other countries around the region. And I think the remedy to this is not less democracy, but more, and helping to strengthen these countries' institutions and the rule of law and things along those lines, because it doesn't take an entire country to attack a small group. All you need is a handful of people to burn down a church or attack Christians. But the important thing is to create a consequence. These people have to be brought to justice, and there has to be accountability for people who carry out these kinds of attacks. And I think that's the key, and not to generalize and indulge in the reverse of what we are condemning overseas.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Khalid El-Gindi, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Michelle Dunn, thank you very much as well.
You're welcome, Marty.
And she's the director of the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. We began with Nancy Youssef, our reporter for McClatchy, who joined us from Cairo. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour, but stay with us. We'll be right back. We've got hour two waiting in the wings. And do say